Hey, Tacoma. What's up? John Doherty here for Radio Tacoma's Climate Talk, the place where we talk about everything climate, always respectfully and with a mix of optimism, sometimes more optimistic than others. This is one of those days where I'm feeling more optimistic, and the reason is because we're going to be talking with Jenny Hitchin. Jenny Hitchin is serving her first term on the Pierce County Council. She represents District 6, and in my view, she's doing a really terrific job of representing the interests of her constituents in Pierce County. And I'm particularly grateful to her for stepping up as a citizen politician. This is Jenny's first elected office, and I think it's really going to be important going forward that we have citizens who are willing to step up and be a voice in creating a better future. So here's our conversation with Jenny Hitchin. Well, we're really pleased to have Jenny Hitchin with us today. Jenny's on the Pierce County Council, District 6. Jenny, welcome.
Thank you, John. It's a pleasure to be here this afternoon.
Yeah, beautiful afternoon, by the way, too. So there's that. So it's been about a year since we've talked. We talked shortly after you took on duties on the Pierce County Council. So I'd like to just start off by, I'm going to call you a citizen politician, if that's okay, because this is your first elected position, and you've been doing your career as a teacher and related prior to that. So This was a new experience for you. So I'm just interested, how has it been for you going from, let's say, the non-political world into the political world?
So great question. And depending on the day of the week, I might give you a different answer as far as what I'm doing. I went from being on my feet and engaging with human beings with all kinds of problems to now doing that work virtually. A lot of it is constituent work through emails and phone calls and then meetings. And due to COVID, a lot of that has been, not in person. And so that's been a challenge, but that's been a challenge for everybody in every line of work other than probably our healthcare workers that are hands-on and some of our other types of employers that, you must be in the field, have been in the field the entire time. But we were able to safely work virtually, including all of our meetings. And so that's been a little bit different, but I am enjoying it, which I wasn't sure. That was one of my big wonderings was, would I get some joy, the same kind of joy, any joy out of doing this? And I'm finding that being able to work with community members and staff to try and troubleshoot, problem solve, long-term plan, those kinds of things. I'm enjoying it.
Yeah. Well, I'm certainly glad to hear that. It's any kind of position like that comes with its challenges, and hopefully it does come with its joys, and it sounds like it does. So, but in this virtual world we've been living in for the last, couple years, I guess, I don't need to exaggerate. I would guess that being on a council, relationships, personal relationships with the other council members, of course, as you mentioned, the staff and so on, are really critically important to getting stuff done. So how has that relationship building been helped or hindered by having to do everything virtually?
So I think there was a kind of a slower ease into doing that due to COVID because so many of the council members were working virtually or for quite a bit of time. There was, they were only in 1 or 2 days a week, and it was really on our really busy days, which tend to be Mondays and Tuesdays. And so there wasn't a lot of time to just stand in a hallway and have a quick conversation while reheating your coffee, right? And those are sometimes where you form those relationships. And so as council members have been coming into the office during, I'm going to call it downtime, though it doesn't really feel like we have a ton of that. But, the days where we don't have a formal meeting and you're just here having time to work on projects or planning or working on policy work, you run into people and have those conversations, or you have a conversation about a piece of legislation that you're working on with another member, and you can actually do that in person for, 20 minutes in your office. And so that has been a good learning process and kind of getting to know little things about people. But I still feel like that's somewhat stifled because part of it is the Open Public Meetings Act, where we can't actually be, you can't take a team of three of us or four of us, depending on, you know, who you're talking about, and have that conversation, even if it's about other things. If it can goes into policy work, you're not supposed to do that. So we have that, which I have found as a former teacher, probably a teacher again someday in the future, but as a former teacher right now, I find it very frustrating because I'm so used to working with groups of people to work together to problem solve, and due to the rules that we follow under to make sure that we're transparent, I can't do that unless we're in an open public meeting. And I knew it was a rule, I just didn't really understand what it meant coming into this role, and figured that out really quickly.
Yeah, I can see how constricting that kind of rule would be, especially in the situation we're in right now. I know from my own corporate career that 20 minutes of actual conversation with a human being face to face is way more potent than formalized kinds of conversations. So I can certainly see that that would be something that would be missed. One of the things I'm just wondering about now, so look at the federal government, and you know, if a psychologist asked me to, you know, what's the first word that comes into your mind when you think of federal government? I think, well, dysfunctional. So we look at the House and the Senate. I mean, they have to struggle to get bills passed to raise the debt ceiling or to fix roads and bridges, which seem like they're really fundamental government functions and shouldn't be a struggle. They are. So I'm just wondering, how do things go on the Pierce County Council? I mean, does work get done fairly smoothly? The communications across the aisle, so to speak, work, so on and so forth. What's going on there?
So I think our biggest challenge was the budget. And I think we learned a lot about each other's priorities going through the policy work to set our 22-23 biennium budget. You know, it became really apparent that there were some areas of government that were deemed really important for some, and as a, you know, and others that were like, no, I don't care. And matter of fact, I'm going to cut that and we're going to do something else. And so that became apparent. But while all of that was going on, we were cordial to each other. We worked together. We communicated effectively. We worked with staff. If there was something where it just needed to be changed a little, like it was a language thing or it was an amount of money we needed to reduce or increase, we talked. And again, with the rules the way they are, essentially, you can never have a quorum of a committee or a council. So four of us council members would not be able to sit and talk about policy. You know, if we're going to a conference and we're riding in a car and we're talking about what we're doing with our families, that's different. But if we're, you know, actually discussing policy, and then if it's committee work, so I'm the chair of human services, if I had two members of my committee, because the committee is five people, that would be a quorum of human services. So we could talk about anything that we wanted as long as it wasn't on the human services list.
Yeah, well, so the key thing that I picked up in your conversation there is that people are talking to each other, and despite the barriers, things are getting done. So on the budget, for instance, would you say that there was a pretty clear split along party lines on what was important and what wasn't? Or did you find yourself in conversations with fellow Democrats about what was important and what wasn't?
There was some party line, and a lot of the party line portions came down around environmental and a few of the human services things. And really, there was some spending on some projects that I personally, as a policymaker, did not seem the right time to be spending the money on that when so much else was going on. A good example of that was the executive had proposed purchasing a building for a portion of office use. And so it was his office and then two other small organizations that work currently in the county city building, moving to this office building. And by the time it was all said and done, it was like a $13 million investment to move people out of a building that right now we are in the middle of a study to find out what are the needs of our law and justice and, you know, services here in the county. And the report doesn't come out until next year. And so I don't want to spend $13 million to buy a building that's not going to solve the problem, because then when we get the report, if we need to do something different or something bigger, we don't have that $13 million back, right? And so, and that clearly came down party lines where we were like, this is a no, we're not doing this.
Yeah, well, one of the things I'm picking up there, which I've been wondering about is the ability of the council to, for lack of a better term, stand up to the executive. And it sounds like you do have that ability that the executive can want something and the council is in a position to keep it from happening. Is that correct?
Yeah, the budget's a little different than policy. So if we were doing a standalone ordinance, the executive would have the ability to veto it, and then we would need a supermajority to overturn his veto, which would require one of the Republicans coming on board if it was along party lines. So it would take a 5-2 vote to overturn a veto. With the budget, we could go through and amend. The likelihood that the budget wouldn't pass as a whole by the time it was all said and done, there was a lot of give and take. There were things that were added and kind of played with that changed what the budget, what the original budget document came from the executive looked like. And one of the things that we did with policy that I'm not going to say it was new, but it was something that we as policymakers really wanted to make sure that we were very clear how we wanted some of these funds to be used or spent, as opposed to here's X number of dollars, just go do whatever. It's here's X number of dollars, and we would like a report back in 6 months, or once you find whatever you were looking for, in this case, maybe like a piece of property to do something with. In our homeless services, we allocated almost $24 million for a program, and we wanted to make sure that absolutely before we spent any of that, because it's a big amount of money, that we knew where it was going, how they were funding it, who were we wanted all the details. And so it was kind of putting, they were called provisos. It was ways to capture and direct what happened with funds once we allocated it through the budget.
Yeah, well, I'm sure your constituents appreciate you keeping track of it, because so many people, and I include myself in that, wonder sometimes if monies that are allocated for a certain purpose are actually well spent. So on behalf of your constituents and everybody else in the county too, as far as that goes, I really appreciate you keeping your eye on where the money is going when you can do that. And also just commenting that the way you describe the situation or the position with the executive, I mean, the executive, he's got a lot of clout. And so it must be somewhat of a challenge to have a Democratic majority on the council and then have a Republican executive.
Yeah, I think for the 4 years he was the executive, when he had the majority, I believe that he kind of got a feel for how things were going to work. And this is the first time that this has happened at this level. It became pretty apparent at the beginning when we first started that there were just things that weren't going to happen. And then there were things that we just didn't even, like, I tried to get hazard pay for grocery workers early on in the pandemic, because we were seeing such, you know, traumatic things happening at a Safeway where, you know, employees were being attacked or, you know, assaulted verbally and all these things. And then employers weren't able to hold on to employees. And I was like, let's just do hazard pay for like a month just to get them to entice them to stay. And it got vetoed before the meeting was even over. And so, you know, it's like it passed. It passed out of the council, but it got vetoed, and we knew there wasn't a single person on the other side that was going to side with us. But it was an interesting. So I hold a record for the fastest veto at the county ever.
Yeah, well, you came. That's pretty exceptional to come right in and start setting records right off the bat.
Yeah, definitely. Well, that's what I was going for, right?
Yeah, maybe not the one you had in mind, but
no. But it was important to me, and I was willing to do it. And we were pretty sure it was going to happen going in. And we even told the organizations that were with us that we were doing it. It was like, we understand this is going to be hard, and we don't think the executive is going to be with us, but it's the wrong message to just say, well, we don't think it's going to pass, so we're not going to run it. And I'm like, yeah, I'll run it. I'll do it. I'll do the work. Cause that's why I'm here. I'm here to help community and make sure voice is heard.
Yeah, I 100% get that. I mean, if somebody wants to say no to something, let's put it out there. and get them on record as saying no to it and press on to other things after what we expect shows up. So this is, after all, a climate program. So I feel like I really do love talking about the sort of the nuts and bolts of county government, because it does seem obscure, I guess, is the word that comes to mind to me as a layperson, you know, exactly what goes, or even approximately what goes on there and so on. So I've appreciated this part. But let's talk a little bit about some climate related stuff. I want to talk about building codes in Pierce County. But before we talk about any specifics, could you explain what the relationship is, or how it works in terms of building codes between municipalities, counties, and the state? How does that all work out?
So I did a little bit of homework, and I think I've got this because I knew this question was coming, but I was not able to run down staff this morning and make sure that I have it exactly right. But from what I remember in talking to staff, essentially we have the Washington State Building Codes, and then you also add the environmental, because a lot of building goes on land. So you've got SEPA and Environmental Protection and all of that portion kind of as the overarching. And then municipalities, which could be cities or counties or towns, have then their own set of regulations. And as I understand it, they cannot be looser than the state. So the state is like the baseline. And then you go to whatever the city, county, or town, depending on where you are. So in my jurisdiction where I cover within the county, my portions of unincorporated Pierce County where they just follow the county rules would be like Parkland and Anderson and Ketron Island. And those that live in Lakewood, Steilacoom, or DuPont follow the building codes that, so again, starting with the state and then whatever the rules to get their permitting for building within those jurisdictions. The caveat is that, or the side note would be water. That is regulated through a lot of different things, but it's mostly through the Tacoma Pierce County Health Department. And so if you, depending on where you're hooking up, and then you also have the fire codes related to water pressure. And so we have all these different rules and they're all kind of regulated by different organizations. But you go to your jurisdiction. So if you don't live in a city or a city, then you go to the county. If you live in a city, then you go to the city and go through that process.
Okay. Well, as you say, we live in a pretty complex world, and my understanding of how codes work just got more complex. So if I understand you, it sounds like let's say unincorporated Pierce County could have a code that was more restrictive than the Washington state code. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay. So let's kind of branch off a little, with this understanding, branch off a little bit. I know that I believe the Pierce County code has been revised, requiring in new residential construction that facilities be built in as the new house is built to provide for charging electric vehicles. Is that right?
It is. It just recently passed. Councilmember Mello and I were working on that together.
Okay, so that would be an example then. So did you have to get approval from the state to have that? No, you
did
not.
It's just our building code.
Okay, awesome. Well, you know, as a person who cares about fossil fuel pollution, I'm really happy to see you guys taking this step, because one of the problems is that when we build infrastructure, regardless whether it's a home or a governmental infrastructure or corporation, when we put something new in, we want to use that new thing for its useful life. And so when we start doing things like putting EV charging stations into a new construction, we're really looking to the future. So I thank you for that. So was it a challenge to get that into the code?
There was some explanation needed, and if I remember correctly, it passed out of committee, no issues, and then I might have gotten a 6-1 vote at the council, but I'd have to go back and look. It wasn't a huge thing. There was actually, I'm trying to remember the meeting where this one passed, and I feel like it was more the parking requirements that were in question, like parking in regards to the number of parking stalls required. We were trying to also reduce that so we could actually, if you're trying to do affordable housing and you're doing it close to like public transit, do you really need to have two full parking spots? And so looking at homes and how you can reduce things like that, especially if it was multifamily. So there was a lot of stuff in here. But the idea of doing plug-in is a pretty simple one and so much easier to do as opposed to retrofitting. You know, when you have just the studs up running wire, and installing the panels as far as just like the power source is way easier than going back and doing it after the fact. So,
yep, for sure. Yeah, I've retrofitted unquote two houses, and while it's not a huge deal, depending on how the wiring and the panel is set up in the house related to the garage and so on, it's not a huge deal, but it's still a cost. And as you say, it makes so much sense to do it while the house is going up. So any talk about multifamily units, because that's a big deal for EVs, because if you know, people with a home can do that transition fairly easily. In fact, even if they are willing to do it, they can just plug into a 110 volt outlet. So what about residential multifamily units looking forward in terms of EVs?
So I pulled the code on that, and what I found, and I'm just going to read it to you because I think okay. It'll be easier. It says EV charging stations are required for multifamily and commercial development at 5% of all parking spaces, and that there's some criteria associated with the building code requirements, such as minimum thresholds. So the way I interpret that, because that was the part that is that essentially new construction that hits a certain threshold, whatever that threshold is, would. So if you were doing a multifamily unit, but it was just a duplex, it probably doesn't hit that threshold. If you're doing an apartment complex where there's 40 units, you would probably hit that threshold, but it would still, the duplex would still be considered multifamily, but it doesn't have enough parking to require it, is the way I interpret that. And then with commercial development, I think you have to have a certain number for EV charging, and you have to have a certain number that are, compliant to get for disabled parking and things like that. So all of that is in that same area of what's required as far as parking and number of parking slots and all of that in that section.
Yeah, well, as I said, I'm really happy to see us making these kind of moves ahead. I'm just curious, there's an organization that I'm just vaguely familiar with called Master Builders Association, I believe it is. So did they chime in on any of the discussions about these code revisions?
Yeah, I'm very sure that they chimed in on us adding something that they would see as an I'm very sure that their policy person chimed in during the meeting to speak against it, because they're always looking at anything that's going to increase the cost to them. And yes, there may be an increase in cost to them to put in this EV, but that just gets passed on to the buyer and again, way less expensive to do it in the front end. And so I think it's, thinking long-term, which with the environment you need to, I think it's an expense that just needs to happen. And I think our builders should be responsible for doing that, and how they want to pay for that, I guess they will figure out. I would see it as an incentive to buy a home if I'm buying a new home and it didn't have some place to charge an electric vehicle in this day and age, I would see that as a, what were you thinking?
Yeah, no, I absolutely. In fact, my own home, I've basically turned it into a green quote unquote home. I've got solar on the roof. I'm all electric. I've got an electric vehicle that I plug into my house and so on and so forth. And before I did all that, I talked with my real estate agent, a woman who's helped me with home purchase and sales over a number of years. I just asking her before I started down this road, what does that mean for the value of my home? And she said, go ahead. That will put a real green premium on your home. People, there's a big market for folks who want those kind of green features. So despite the master builder's apparent foot dragging, I think you're right that especially 5 or 10 years from now,
right,
people are going to be saying, what on earth were you thinking? So Anyway, so what else? Anything else? I know I wanted to ask you, natural gas into new construction. Is there any talk about prohibiting natural gas into new construction?
Not that I've heard yet, but I know that our 2030 sustainability plan that did pass clearly outlines the idea of reducing carbon emissions. It says by 45% by 2030, which again technically is not the threshold that we really want, but at least it's. I mean, I think we're supposed to be trying to reduce by 50% by 2030 is I think the number I've heard. If you can't do higher than that, but this is what we were able to get past was the 45%, and so I think that we are looking at a lot of different pathways to get there. And I know that one of our investments this go around when the budget was actually investing in people to be doing this work, to really make sure that this pretty extensive list of to do in the county, whether it's, you know, educating people on how we reduce food waste, because that's one of our producers of gas, and then it's just, you know, trash, which takes up space. And then you have all along the lines of infrastructure where, you know, can we coordinate our lights so that people are not sitting and idling for so long, and doing a simple traffic study on where we're seeing people sitting for longer periods of time. And then you look at how traffic flow. I mean, who does that work? Well, we are setting aside people to go in and really look at each of these action items in our 2030 sustainability plan to what do we need to do to get to this goal? What has to change? So what are we doing with, you know, our stormwater runoff and the changes to what's acceptable going into the Sound and what's not? And what do we need to do to clean that up so that we aren't polluting the Sound just with stormwater runoff? All those things take somebody driving, somebody doing that work. And so we made some investments in people to help us do that work now more closely.
Yeah, so that's an interesting perspective that I don't really think about very much, is that while we have a fairly clear idea of what we want to do, not so much a clear idea, okay, well, who's going to do it? So that sounds like a really valuable initiative. So looking downstream from your perspective, especially around climate-related stuff, what do you see as priorities for the council in the next few years in terms of environment and climate?
So we have a couple opportunities coming through funds that are coming from the state, but also we're making an assumption from the federal level when it comes to our salmon restoration, whether it's, you know, updating, removing, changing culvert situations, looking at our stormwater discharge, looking at our communities that are struggling with their wastewater treatment, you know, and what's coming out of our plants and then going into Sound and some of our other bodies of water. And then in my district, we're having issues with PFAS. So water, I think, is going to be a big thing over the next couple years as we move forward. And we've got some pretty intentional spending plans going forward. A good example is looking at removing the Chambers Bay Dam because that is such a rich ecosystem as far as, I think, a couple different species of salmon that used to use that area and then just are not successful breaching that dam and getting into their spawning areas. And so we have commissioned and allocated funds to do the study to actually figure out how to do this. And then we're going to be lobbying down in Olympia to get funding to help support that. We're working with our different partners in the climate world. So some of our salmon organizations and then tribal organizations, because it's in the tribal fishing areas for I think several of our tribes. And so it's looking at how do we tag team and work on this, because it's a big deal, because you've got not just the dam removal, but if the dam comes down, you have to replace the bridge. So we've got two things that have to happen essentially simultaneously. And that's a good like partnership using federal, state, county dollars, using some city partners, tribal partners to really do something very intentional that's going to help it. Help long term. And I know that both myself, Councilmember Young, or Chair Young, and Councilmember Mello have talked, you know, at different points about different things. How do we do fill in the blank, you know, how do we push an electric first policy when we're buying vehicles at the county? Let's talk through that. And so those little things, but the little things that add up over time when you start thinking about actions that, you know, work over time and perpetuate, they can either perpetuate good, you know, or they can perpetuate bad. So let's stop buying fossil fuel guzzling large trucks if we can find an electric or a hybrid model that works just as well. But right now, they don't want to do that work. And so it's like, how do we push them to make that time to go and do that? I hope that made sense. Sorry, I kind of went off on a tangent there.
No, it made total sense. And one of my takeaways is that there is so much work being done at the county level. And I think a lot of that work goes on under the popular perception or the popular radar. And I can see why. So you are not teaching anymore.
This is absolutely a full-time job.
I know. Well, I get that it's a full-time job because, you know, in the past I've had that, council member on the county, how tough can it be? But it seems like it's pretty crazy. It also pulls up the idea for me, the old saw about all politics is local. And so you're really right in the thick of it with the county politics, and they're critical issues for us, but, you know, they're critical issues for like-sized local governmental agencies all over the world. And so I'm really appreciative of the work that you're doing. We're about out of time here. Anything else that you want to finish up with, Jenny, before we call it a day?
Well, thank you for the time. And always, again, enjoy working with you and talking with you. I think that the biggest thing is if people are aware of things, if people that listen to your podcast and radio show here, you know, if there's things that they're aware of or things that, you know, they need to flag, a lot of times people get frustrated, so they don't talk to us, and we don't have eyes and ears everywhere. And so there are things that slip under the radar because nobody says anything, or they had a bad experience the last time they reached out to local government. And so if people have ideas or know things that are going on in other areas, you know, just using us as a sounding board, even if you just send one email or one phone call and just go, hey, I have this brainstorm about this, or they're doing this in this county over here in Massachusetts, and it's great. It's really helping with, I don't know, shellfish or something. I may not find that. My staff may not find that. And so it's about pulling people together and bringing brain power together to try and solve this. Because when we're talking about climate change, it takes all of us working together if we really want to be able to make it here on planet Earth. Because there's no place to go. We got to stay here.
Yeah, for sure. Well, after listening to everything that's on your plate and everything that's on the council's and county government's plate, I'm doubly appreciative of you taking a half an hour of your day to talk to me, talk to our listeners. And I will certainly reinforce that notion. Hey, something is of interest or concern for you in the county. The council members want to hear you. One of the things I say often is that the least effective voice is the one that's not raised. And I think a lot of people think, well, what difference can I make? And you're saying, yes, you can make a difference. So once again, Jenny, so much. Thanks so much for taking the time with us, and have a great rest of your day.
Will do. You too. And Happy New Year.
All right. Happy New Year to you. Bye. Well, there you have it. Great talking with Jenny Hitchin today. I hope you will follow up with her point about letting her specifically and our elected representatives in general know what's on your mind. I'd appreciate getting your thoughts on this program as well as others. You can contact me at John, J-O-H-N, at ccltacoma.org. The CCL part is for Citizens Climate Lobby. You can check out the local chapter of Citizens Climate Lobby at ccltacoma.org. A reminder also that this program, as well as all other locally produced programming, is available on the KTAH website. Just do a search for KTAH, look for programming, and you can find the archive right there. So here I am once again, urging you to always live like the mountain is out. Take care now.